On this edition for Saturday, May 2nd, states across the country move to reopen for business. Tenants' rights groups call for a nationwide rent strike and a dream specialist on COVID-19 dreams. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. The decision to reopen or remain under strict lockdowns is facing the nation's governors this weekend. Dozens of states are now trying a variety of changes as the spread of the coronavirus is slowing, at least for now. Here in New York, the epicenter of the U.S. COVID-19 pandemic, strict stay-at-home orders remain in place, and we are bringing you our reporting from remote locations, often from our homes. Let's get started with today's top news. On the first weekend in May, more states continued to loosen restrictions and reopen businesses closed in the coronavirus pandemic. New Jersey opened its state and county parks and golf courses today, the state's first easing of the restrictions that still include a stay-at-home order and mandatory wearing of face masks in many places.
With the reopening of our parks and golf courses will be a crucial test, and this is a test that we must pass.
New York City began to, quote, open streets to pedestrians and cyclists today to make room for more outdoor exercise.
We want to expand the parks, if you will, by opening up these streets.
Mayor Bill de Blasio started with 7 miles, mostly in parks, and says he plans to add about 40 more miles this month. In California, where there have been protests against the governor's recent order to hard close some beaches temporarily, there were new demands to reopen more of the state. Yesterday, Governor Gavin Newsom said he may announce an easing of the stay-at-home order as early as Monday.
The only thing that's going to hold us back is the spread of this virus.
Los Angeles Times reporter Phil Willon is covering the governor and California's reopening.
His approval rating is through the roof still. People really like the job he's done handling the coronavirus. So he has a lot of goodwill still. But I think like everywhere in the country, people have been inside for over a month. They're getting antsy. The weather's getting warm. And a lot of people are hurt financially, and we need to get back to work. So there's these dueling pressures, and he has to face it's a pretty complicated juggling act.
COVID-19 infections in the U.S. make up about one-third of cases in the world. So far, more than 65,000 deaths in the U.S. have been attributed to the disease, and hospitals continue to treat new cases every day. After leaving the White House for a weekend at Camp David yesterday, President Trump nominated a replacement for Health and Human Services Acting Inspector General Kristi Grimm. Grimm released a report on April 3rd that showed hospitals were experiencing, quote, severe shortages of testing supplies and extended waits for test results and widespread shortages of personal protective equipment. The spread of the coronavirus continues to slow down in parts of Europe as countries there are also beginning to ease restrictions. Today, adults in Spain exercised outside for the first time in 7 weeks. 4 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the evening are set aside for adults. Children have time in the afternoon, and the remaining hours are reserved for the elderly and vulnerable. The new rules are part of the gradual easing of one of the strictest lockdowns in Europe. But many restrictions remain. The Prime Minister is asking Parliament to extend the country's state of emergency. And starting Monday, face masks will be mandatory on public transit. Up to now, they were only recommended. In Austria, most businesses are now open, including hair salons and larger retail shops. However, restaurants and bars remain closed. Austria was one of the countries to impose a lockdown in mid-March. And while parts of Europe are loosening restrictions, Russia announced today that coronavirus cases hit a new daily high. Parts of the country, including Moscow, have been under lockdown, and officials warn that if cases continue to rise, more restrictions might be imposed. North Korean state media released a video today that it said showed leader Kim Jong-un touring a fertilizer factory yesterday. The video shows Kim inspecting the factory with high-ranking officials and his sister. It is the North Korean leader's first public appearance in nearly 3 weeks. Speculation about Kim's health began after he missed a ceremony marking the birthday of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, on April 15th. Following his absence, a South Korean news outlet reported that Kim was recovering from heart surgery, but there has been no comment on that from U.S. officials. A 5.4 magnitude earthquake struck southern Puerto Rico this morning, just 5 months after a bigger quake struck the same area. Today's quake hit near the coastal city of Ponce a little after 7 a.m. There were reports of structural damage to buildings, but as of this afternoon, no casualties were reported. The U.S. Geological Survey said this was an aftershock of the larger 6.4 magnitude earthquake that hit southern Puerto Rico on January 6. That quake killed one person and destroyed hundreds of homes in the area. For more news of the day and a special feature on the Levon Helm Studios in Woodstock, New York, featuring singer-songwriter John Sebastian, visit pbs.org/newshour. Antibody testing for COVID-19 is becoming more readily available, but there are still multiple unknowns about what the test results actually mean when it comes to public health. I recently spoke with ProPublica health reporter Caroline Chen to help explain some of the confusion. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us. There's been such an intense focus on antibody tests, both here in the U.S. and overseas, but not without controversy. And some of the methodologies that are used in the studies have been questioned as well for bias and sort of other elements that can, you know, sort of sway results. So how reliable are these tests and how dangerous is a false positive?
Yeah, so there are many questions you asked right there. So let me break this down a little bit here. So antibody studies that are now being conducted nationwide at state levels and even at county levels are really, really important because they can actually answer many questions. But the most common type of study that's being done right now is to ask this very basic question, which is what percentage of this population has been infected? What they're doing is that they're supposed to look at a random sample of a given population, let's say in this specific county or in this specific state, and by taking a random selection of the population and looking in their blood to see if they have antibodies, you can get a sense of what portion of that population has been infected. And that's really important because to date, as we know in the US, there has been a shortage of the diagnostic test. And so only really, you know, people who have had really severe symptoms, who have gone to the hospital, have managed to get tested. So we know that the case counts are probably an undercount, but we don't know how much of an undercount. So that's where these studies can help to fill in our understanding. So you mentioned that there's been some controversy about these, and they're kind of maybe two big pieces of this. So the first thing you said is accuracy of the tests, right? So if the tests aren't super accurate, then of course that can skew the numbers. Everybody understands that part. The other trickier part is what you mentioned, which is bias. And what scientists mean when they say bias is that they mean that they're worried that the sample that was tested wasn't totally random. And there are many different ways you can recruit participants, but basically the concern is if you're saying you volunteer, whether I'm recruiting you by Facebook ad or whether I'm just posting something on the internet and saying, email me if you want to participate, that the fear is that people who think that they have been infected, who say, oh, I had a flu back in February or I had a cough back in February, they're more motivated to participate. Whereas if I say, oh, I've been totally healthy this whole time, I don't think I had the coronavirus, I'm going to not want to participate. And that could skew the numbers. So the ideal way to do this type of study is to, you know, have a database of addresses and then to randomly pick addresses and then invite people to participate.
And the results of who has the antibody and who doesn't, there's a vast range of differences. I've seen numbers as low as 2% all the way up to 30%. So how do those numbers compare to so-called herd immunity and the metric that they're looking for that?
I think as these numbers have come out, you know, whether it is down at 2% or whether it is up at 30%, which was in Chelsea, Massachusetts, I think a lot of the headlines people are seeing go along the lines of, you know, there are far more infections in our community than were previously thought. And I think that that is one that is true. So then some people start to say, so are we actually close to herd immunity? And herd immunity is the idea that when the vast majority of the population is infected, that the virus will not have enough new potential carriers to infect, and so it will stop circulating. Now, I think it's really helpful to just keep some numbers in your mind. So I've asked a lot of scientists, how many people need to be infected for there to be herd immunity? And I've gotten a range of answers, but the lowest number I've heard is 60%. Most people say 70 to 80%. I've heard as high as 90%. The reason why that's not a fixed number is because it depends on a number of different factors, like how contagious exactly the coronavirus is, and also this still open question of, if you have been infected, are you then immune forever, like the chicken pox? Or right. Does your immunity actually start to wane over time? All the studies that have come out in the US regionally, we're nowhere near herd immunity. So unfortunately, I think the only other way to get to herd immunity is via vaccine, and that's also some ways away.
So much of this is uncharted territory. When do you think it will be possible, taking all these snapshots, to put them together and get some sort of sense of where we actually stand as a country, how many people have the antibodies, and when we can start sort of thinking about, as a whole country, going back to work and feeling much safer?
I think that actually, we're going to be able to get a good sense regionally and sort of maybe at a potentially at a county level, you know, even within weeks, because there are some counties like Miami-Dade County that are already doing this on a weekly basis. And in New York State, where they are already updating their numbers because they are doing this on a weekly basis. So I think, you know, you may not have a perfect picture already, but you are already starting to have a picture that is becoming more and more in focus. Week by week as you do this. And I think that's very hopeful because we can get more and more information as we go, even if it's not yet perfect. And learning the proportion of people who are infected in the population is so important for us to better understand the coronavirus and also to get a sense of how fast is this disease spreading. Like, these are all important pieces of information, both for scientists to understand the virus and for politicians to get a sense of what's happening in their city as they make decisions on things like, should we reopen? How fast should we reopen? Are the social distancing measures helping? And also, they'll start to do these studies in select populations, like what portion of healthcare workers or frontline workers, like grocery store workers, are infected. Like, all these pieces of information start to help build a better picture regionally, statewide, countywide, and then maybe put them together to get a picture of the nation.
Caroline Chen, ProPublica, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The 1st of May marked the second month since coronavirus shutdowns, when rent for millions of Americans was due. With more than 30 million people filing for unemployment benefits in the past 6 weeks, tenant groups across the country yesterday called for a rent strike until the economy recovers. NewsHour Weekend's Sam Weber has more.
At an apartment building in Queens, New York, tenants came to their windows yesterday afternoon and collectively made noise. This display wasn't the daily appreciation for essential workers. It was a strike declaration. Several dozen tenants announced they would not be paying rent this month.
We are working class people. We go month to month without bills.
Christina Jeffers is one of those tenants. She's a housekeeper who's not been able to work since mid-March.
Many of us, our salary is a big chunk for rent. We really in trouble. That's why we decide to go into this strike.
Across New York City, organizers estimate that more than 50 buildings have organized to formally withhold rent. And more than 13,000 individual tenants in the city are striking on their own. Rent strikes have also been organized nationally, from Los Angeles to Seattle to Chicago. Organizers believe it's the largest coordinated rent strike in almost a century.
We are encouraging people who already can't pay to come into a movement to not pay together, to turn the fact that you can't pay into political action.
Sia Weaver is the campaign coordinator for Housing Justice for All, a coalition of 70 housing groups across New York State. She says rent needs to be suspended for the duration of the coronavirus crisis.
We want federal or state action, both if needed. And the goal really here is we're trying to create a crisis for the real estate industry that will force the governor to act.
While rent is still due, all evictions have been put on hold in New York and at least 19 other states. And the Federal CARES Act, passed in late March, halted evictions nationally for tenants in federal housing programs or where the underlying mortgage is backed by a federal housing agency. Weaver says pausing evictions just delays the inevitable.
It's the definition of kicking the bucket down the road. And if we don't get some real rent relief, if we don't get rents canceled, we are going to see a never before experienced wave of evictions when housing courts reopen on June 20th.
But there has been some momentum for suspending rent. In mid-April, Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar introduced a bill that would cancel rent and mortgage payments while there's a federal disaster declaration. New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one of the bill's co-sponsors, and she spoke about the need to support rent strikes at a virtual town hall earlier this week.
People aren't striking because they don't feel like paying rent. People are striking because they can't pay rent. They can't.
But to many of those who collect rent payments, the strikes represent a real economic threat.
To me, it's reckless and it is potentially damaging to the economy.
Doug Bibby is the president of the National Multifamily Housing Council, an advocacy group representing apartment owners. He says when renters don't pay, there's a cascading effect on the housing industry.
Many apartment owners are small businesses. And those small businesses have a mortgage on the property and they have a payroll, their employees, and they have property taxes and insurance. When landlords don't get the money, they have to make a decision on what to cut.
In April, more than 91% of the rent was collected by the end of the month, according to national data compiled by Bibby's group, a slight decrease from the month before. But Bibby worries that things will get much worse for landlords as the economic downturn continues.
I understand people are feeling pain and they're feeling frustrated and they don't have the resources. But the best way to do this thing is not to call a renter strike, is to flood the congressmen and senators' offices with appeals for help. Because what we need right now is the government to step in. This cannot be solved by the private sector.
In Queens, tenant Christina Jeffers knows that her building's owner alone can't solve the economic crisis, but she says it could be doing more.
They have the money to survive without our 3 or 4 months rent. They do.
Jeffers' landlord did not respond to a request to comment from PBS NewsHour Weekend. As policymakers try to address the concerns of both renters and landlords, NYU professor Kathy O'Regan says the crisis has also magnified longstanding disparities in housing. Rents have been rising, and renters, on the whole, have less income and savings than homeowners.
One of the things that I worry about is the way that this crisis has rolled out and revealed and heightened racial and ethnic disparities, right? So you have a health crisis that very disproportionately affected people of color. Renters are now the ones most at risk. Disproportionately households of color. If we do not stop the rental crisis, we're going to be taking what were pre-existing disparities and we're going to be widening them. This is a moment to close the gap. It is certainly a moment not to let the gap get wider.
It's not hard to imagine worries about COVID-19 keeping people up at night, but around the world, people have been reporting that the pandemic is affecting their dreams as well. NewsHour Weekend's Maury Rothman has our report.
Deirdre Barrett has been having strange dreams lately.
I was in a very beautiful antique library, like the library of a home, and I knew that outside there was just some horrible thing happening. And it kind of transformed from being a war to being a riot to being something like the Black Plague.
Barrett created this eerie depiction of her dream, but she's more than an artist. Barrett is an expert on dreaming. She's studied the science of dreams for 4 decades and written a book on the subject. Now she's collecting accounts of COVID-19 related dreams to learn about how people's dreams are being influenced by the pandemic.
What kind of dreams are you seeing people report?
In the survey I'm doing, there's some big clusters of types of dreams. People are dreaming that they're getting short of breath, they're spiking a fever, or more fantastically, one woman looks down at her stomach and sees blue stripes on it, and in the dream remembers that that's the first sign of coronavirus and knows she has it. There's a big cluster of metaphoric ones about the virus, but representing it as something else. The biggest subpart of that are bugs. Every kind of bug, cockroaches rushing toward the person, swarms of flying insects, masses of squirming worms. I think we see so many bugs because it's a common phrase. I have a bug means I have a virus, but also because the virus is so invisible, lots of small things that cumulatively can kill you, like bugs, makes a good metaphor.
Barrett says in the thousands of dream reports she's received, the pattern is shifting from initial fears of the virus to aspects of being in lockdown. And she's not the only one collecting dreams. On a website called I Dream of COVID, gathering dreams from around the world, some wrote of bizarre things, including never-ending video conferences, items in a grocery store coughing and sneezing, and relationship troubles brought on by uncut hair. Barrett says most dream activity tends to occur towards the end of slumber, during a period that is often interrupted by the alarm to wake up. But because many people are home all day, some are sleeping longer. So it makes sense that more people are remembering dreams when they awaken.
You've looked at dreams of people who have gone through past major events, 9/11, for example, where there was more stark imagery. Kind of how does this compare?
The way the 9/11 sample and this one are very similar is that in both, the ordinary person who's watching this on television and is certainly stressed and worried about it, but not really experiencing what psychologists usually mean by a trauma, they're mostly having anxiety dreams.
But what about the extraordinary person, the one dealing with the crisis on the front lines?
In both of the samples, 9/11 and the pandemic, the first responders are the ones who have just horrible post-traumatic nightmares, much more literally about the events.
And at what point do these dreams kind of help us process what's going on, and at what point are they not as helpful?
I think a lot of the questions that we ask about dreams, we should kind of think of the equivalent in waking thought. Like if you try to think about, are most of your waking thoughts helping you process what's going on? Well, some of them are definitely good ideas and breakthroughs about what to do and getting you somewhere. But an awful lot of waking thought is just repetitive circles. And I've thought this over and over yesterday, and I'm doing it again today. And I think our dreams are like that also.
And if the dreams get to be overwhelming, Barrett says there are steps you can take to try to at least make them a little less upsetting.
If people just want to stop having bad anxiety dreams, the best method is to think of what you would like to dream about. Maybe a favorite loved one, maybe a favorite vacation spot. Lots of people love flying dreams. And so to, as you're falling asleep, to form an image of that in your mind, then it makes it less likely you'll have the anxiety dreams and more likely you'll have the content you're targeting.
We asked you to tell us about some of your COVID dreams. Here are some of your responses. Janina Schiavone from Michigan wrote, "Everyone I miss so much was there. My wonderful friends, my teammates from work, my family, and remarkably, all those I've loved in the past who are no longer with me on this earth. I know I didn't want the dream to end, and when it did, I was smiling. Then I cried, then I smiled again." Ryan Brennan from St. Louis, Missouri, recalled his dream. "I'm a high school teacher. At work, we had a fire drill, and Oprah yelled at me because I took too long to take attendance of my class after evacuating the building." And this from Kate Buick in Seattle. "I was in church, sitting up front, appropriately physically distanced from others. However, when I turned around, I saw a large group of people packed in closely together at the back. I thought to myself, I shouldn't be here, and left right away. When I came fully awake, I was so relieved that it wasn't real."
Music.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Corina Mitchell. Thanks for watching. Stay safe and have a great night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.